Hi, I'm Candace Michelle, and welcome to another segment of Our Community. Today I'm talking again with Richard Heap about one of our favorite topics here on the coast, our salmon population. Rich has been involved as an advocate for Oregon fisheries and helping with restoration of salmon habitat on the Chetco and Windchuck Rivers for years, as well as doing population inventory and surveys. Salmon have a complicated life cycle. In our last interview, he told us all about that and what some of the ongoing challenges are that the fish face. Today, we're going to talk about the official 2018 salmon season, which was just announced. Welcome to the show, Rich.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to have you here. I told you I was probably going to embarrass you by telling you this, but I got to tell you, you are one of my favorite people to interview. You're only like so knowledgeable and you can talk forever about your subject.
And I do sometimes, unfortunately.
We love it. So, Rich, I think that you just got back from Portland, you said?
We finished the Pacific Fisheries Council meeting last week in Portland. It was the second of two meetings that deal with salmon seasons. The first is in March, and that was in Rohnert Park, California. And at that meeting, the council selects three alternatives to send out for public review and comment, three alternatives for salmon seasons.
And that was what happened in March.
That happened in March.
And that was the report that you gave in front of the port commissioners a few weeks ago.
Exactly.
Okay. I'm just trying to piece this all together because I was there and I listened to you speaking, and I have to admit, I just didn't quite get it.
Well, this because it's covered under NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act.
Okay.
That was done years and years ago. Nixon actually signed that bill. And what that required is any significant federal action had to have an environmental analysis or an environmental impact statement written about it. And that had to go out for public review. Because this is a federal process, there is an environmental analysis performed on those three alternatives between the two meetings. And
wow.
That's part of it.
Wow.
So what the council's really after is input from the public. This is one of the more public processes I've ever been involved with. The public, in fact, has a great deal of influence over what happens.
So they not only ask the public's opinion, but they actually listen?
Yes.
Wow.
Well, the advisory panel that I sit on, called the Salmon Advisory Subpanel, is 13 people, and there are no government people on that at all. It's all citizens, fishermen primarily.
Wow.
And we are the group that make recommendations to the council about season dates, bag limits, all the alternatives come from us. And then they sort through that, and the information is sent to a group called the Salmon Technical Team, who are agency people, and their role is basically to do the modeling and make sure all the numbers that we have to work toward fit.
So, now, for somebody who doesn't understand what you mean by salmon season, what does that mean?
Well, it's the official season where we can go fish.
So you can't just
commercial and recreational.
Okay.
No, it's governed by a season structure, a bag limit structure. There are length requirements. It's a pretty long regulatory process.
Okay.
Now, this is in the ocean from 3 miles to 200 miles. That's the jurisdiction of the Fishery Management Council.
200 miles out.
Right. From the shoreline to 3 miles are state waters.
Oh.
So the state has jurisdiction there. And in this case, the state's meeting today as we speak to establish the state season, which always mirrors the federal season.
Okay.
The state does set some unique fisheries like the Chetco bubble fishery here, which is in October. It's actually the Chetco terminal ocean season. And that's being reviewed today as well.
So the bubble season, I think we talked about that the last time, but it's just like a little tiny window where you can actually catch fish.
Right. It's intended to target Chetco fish.
Okay.
And as opposed to
They're the ones that are coming back.
Right.
Right.
As opposed to the regular ocean season, which is targeting mixed stocks of fish. In our case, it's primarily the Sacramento and Klamath is where our fish come from that we catch, the Chinook. The Chetco season is intended to target returning Chetco fish.
Now, I found it very interesting the last time we were talking. You said that our fish do a kind of a funny thing when they go out the mouth of the Chetco, they turn left, whereas a lot of the fish, the other salmon from California and stuff, turn right. So our fish are going kind of in a different direction.
Right. Our fish actually go down off of Mendocino County, off the Mendocino coast. There's a bunch of big canyons that come in from the ocean, deep canyons that come in that provide good upwelling. And I think our fish over time evolve to take advantage of that. I mean, there's no plausible explanation for why these fish all do a right turn except this particular group from the Rogue South.
So every other salmon goes north.
Well, if you just go north of us a little ways to the Elk River, for example, they're all right turning fish. They spend most of their life off of Alaska. But when you get to Euchre Creek right above Gold Beach, you get to Euchre Creek, the Rogue River, Hunter Creek, Pistol River, Chetco, Winchuck, and they all go south.
That's so bizarre.
It is. It's a fascinating adaptation.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so what were you doing in Portland?
So this was the final meeting on the salmon season. And at this time, we took the three alternatives, combined it with public comment, and narrowed it down to one season alternative.
So how were the three alternatives? I mean, how did they come up with those?
Well,
or is that too complicated to even discuss?
Well, I'll try. So what happens is in February, we get the forecast for what's going to be in the ocean by stock. So for example, this year, we knew that in the ocean, there was estimated to be 239,000 Sacramento fish, 331,000 Klamath fish, and 462,000 Rogue fish. And that's an extremely high number for Rogue. It's normally not near that. The Sacramento.
Do they have any reason why that number would be?
Well, possibly because they're left turning. What could have happened is that particular area of the ocean recovered much more quickly than the rest from the ocean warming conditions we've experienced for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, the Klamath fish, which also go to the same place ours do, did well. Much better than we expected. So we have that forecast. We also have guidance from the National Marine Fisheries Service that gives us numbers we have to work toward. And those numbers are based on the requirements of fisheries management plans. So in the case of the Sacramento, there's an escapement range of 181,000 on the top end to 122,000 on the bottom.
Okay, so what does that mean,
that
escapement range?
Escapement, that's the number of fish, adult fish, that come back to spawn after all fishing has been accounted for.
Okay. Okay, so they're escaping the fishing so that they can go up and spawn.
Right.
Got
so
it.
When we went this year, the guidance was pretty vague. What they said is, we'd like you to stay near the top end of the range. Well, we didn't know what that meant. Exactly. And they didn't specify exactly.
Okay. And when they say we want you to stay near the top end, what exactly does that?
In this case, that's 180,000.
Okay.
So what we decided to do, the state of Oregon and California got together, and we said, let's come up with three alternatives, one based on 180, one based on 165, and one based on 151. So 151 would be the most liberal season. We put that all together, and that's what the three alternatives were basically.
Were based on those three different numbers. Okay.
So at 180, you're looking at about 60,000+ fish available for harvest.
Okay.
It can, because you start with 229 and you do the math. So
okay. 229, taking away the 180 that you want to be able to make it up to spawn,
right.
Leaves.
It may be higher than that. I'm thinking that the 151 is like 72,000 or something in that range.
Okay.
So that's what we came out with. And of course, the public generally will accept the best season alternative, which in this case was alternative one, which managed down to 151,000. So when we went in April, the National Marine Fisheries Service then said, okay, we're going to accept that.
Was that surprising?
It was to me.
Because they wanted you to go with the higher number.
Well, what they wanted to do was review the challenge to the economic return from these fish based on all three of those alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
And so the combination of conservation, we're still above the 120,
mm-hmm.
122, the minimum, absolute minimum. And the economic benefit realized by the communities, I think, was what made the difference. So they said that's probably the best choice given those two factors.
Because if we have not done well in the last few years for salmon season, and that seems to be the case, we feel it in the community.
The part of the in-between process is another report written by the council staff, and that's called Preseason Report 2, which is the environmental analysis necessary for looking at those alternatives. And in that, there is an economic piece. The recreational salmon fishery in the Klamath Management Zone and all of California is somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 million just on the recreational side.
Wow.
So you expand that to a coastwide basis from Washington to all the way through California, you're talking a lot of money, just recreational fishing. Then you throw the commercial fishery in on top of that,
mm-hmm.
and you're talking hundreds of millions of dollars in value to the community.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a community-based value. This isn't something that disappears into the netherland.
Right, when fishermen come here and buy bait
and stay in motels and
exactly.
launch their boats and the rent slips, that's community. That's money direct to our community.
Absolutely, and stays in the community, which
right.
is, you know, helpful, especially when you've got the last couple of years have been, you know, sort of a disaster in terms of fishing.
Yes.
Okay, so you're up in Portland, and you are now at this meeting that is going to determine which one of those three is going to be.
So we, on the first day, we then sit down and come up with one alternative.
Wow.
And we read that out on the council floor, and then the council directs the salmon technical team to go do their modeling on that. Then they give a report back to the council where we're not meeting the numbers. Then the council gives further direction to that team. We come back as a salmon advisory subpanel with that direction and make it work. And it sometimes takes us three or four times to do this. It seems simple to get to the number, but to get to the number sometimes requires pretty big sacrifice. And
tell me about that.
Well, okay, so let's talk about Sacramento fish. And talk about the zones. There are various management zones up and down the coast. So in order to have our full season from mid-May through the end of August, near the end of August, we had 450 Sacramento impacts. Impact is a way of describing the number of fish that are actually harvested
okay.
of that stock. So in our case, we get about, for every Klamath fish that we actually see in the creel, Sacramento fish that we see in the creel that we know is a Sacramento fish. The assumption is that there's probably a large number of those that we didn't see through creel.
Mm-hmm.
In our case, it's about 40 per one. When you go down to the San Francisco.
Now, how do you figure that out?
That's based on coated wire tags primarily.
Okay.
So when
okay.
we see a coated wire tag that's an American River fish out of the Sacramento Basin, we assume that for that, there's probably another 40 unmarked fish that are from that same area that we couldn't actually detect.
Right.
When you go down to the San Francisco area on Sacramento's, their impacts were in the 10,000 range for their seasons, which are not as big as ours. So if you have to make a difference, let's say we've got to come up with, we have to reduce by 200 fish.
Mm-hmm.
If you would come up to or 200 impacts, let's talk impacts.
Okay.
If you were to come to us and ask me to give up 200 impacts in the Klamath Management Zone portion of Oregon, that's half the season or better.
Right, that's huge.
You go to the San Francisco cell, that's
right.
maybe a half a day of fishing.
Right.
So we do that swapping back and forth to try and make all that work. We also talk about harvest between commercial and recreational sectors
mm-hmm.
and between states. So we get all that stuff put together and we come up with one that will work. The complicated system, the most complicated system, is what's called north of Falcon. Cape Falcon is at Manzanita, Oregon, and we manage fisheries. That's almost to, up to Astoria.
Okay,
it's way south of Astoria.
Okay,
above Tillamook. We manage fisheries generally based on a north of Falcon and south of Falcon. North of Falcon is almost entirely dominated by Columbia River stocks.
And okay, because they turned...
They're right turns.
They turned right.
So you have coastal Oregon fish, Columbia River fish, and coastal Washington fish that are all in that north of Falcon fishery. You also have 22 treaty tribes who are co-managers.
Okay.
And you have...
Now that must be... That adds a complication,
it
right?
Does.
22 tribes?
It does.
Okay.
And they do their own process.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a council representative. Mm-hmm. Then you also have to look at the number of fish you're going to allow back in the Columbia River for escapement and also for recreational fishing clear into Idaho. And then you
They go clear into Idaho?
Yes.
Wow. The
Snake River is the, before the dams were built anyway, was the upriver terminus of Chinook. When I worked in northeastern Nevada, historically, there were Columbia River salmon spawning in Nevada in two places. But with the construction of all the dams, that went away.
Yeah, I mean, it does make you just kind of be in awe of how far they were willing to travel.
Well, they're all uniquely adapted to do that. Mm-hmm. And as you run up and down the coast and you look at the timing of when the adults enter the stream... It's all different.
Hmm.
For example, on the Chetco, we see our adults coming in September and October and into November.
Right.
If you go to the Rogue, which is a much longer system, those fish show up in July and August and
wow.
September. And so it's all adapted to the habitat and to the length of the stream. The Columbia has salmon in it probably moving up 12 months out of the year to the various tributaries where they
spawn.
So.
Wow. So if you've got just, and I'm just taking a little side detour here. So if you've got the fish that are returning in the Rogue during different months than they're returning in the Chetco, how do you figure out when you can fish?
Well, I mentioned that the forecast was 462,000 Rogue fish.
Right.
That's a lot of fish coming by us because those fish are coming also from Mendocino County where they went.
Of course, because they turned
right.
left.
Okay,
right.
So we tried to build our fisheries here in July and August to take advantage of those fish going by Brookings.
Okay.
And that's why we, because we're doing Sacramentals, that's why we did a July and August fishery.
Got it.
And we actually got just about the longest season on the coast because of that.
So when now does salmon season 2018 start?
So for the recreational season, it is May 19th through August 26th.
And that's a fairly long season.
Yeah, I normally figure if we can fish Memorial Day through Labor Day, that's a full season.
Right.
We don't have many. The reason I picked mid-May is because historically the first recorded catches we get in the recreational fishery are usually in mid-May. So there's no sense adding days on before that.
Right.
Plus May is usually not a good weather month.
Right.
I did not fish into September this year. Asked not to fish into September this year because once you reach September 1st, a lot of things change. And well, not a lot of things. One thing changes.
Mm-hmm.
The fisheries management plan dictates that on September 1st, all Klamath River fish that are still in the ocean become 1 year older.
Yeah. Okay, that feels a little arbitrary.
It is. It is, but there's some rationale for that.
Okay.
So what that means is anything we don't model in September. We model up through the end of August.
Mm-hmm.
Anything caught in the ocean after September that are Klamath fish count against next year's fishery.
Oh.
They come right off the top.
Oh.
And as a consequence, you can have some pretty big bites taken out of your available impacts when that happens. So if, for example, a Klamath fish last year, one Klamath fish was worth 20. One Klamath impact was worth 20 fish. I'm sorry, I'm getting this confusing.
But one was equivalent to 20.
So if we caught, let's say 50 Klamath fish,
mm-hmm.
then we're taking a lot right off the top.
Wow.
Of next year. So we are always careful about September. And this year, even though the Klamath forecast looks pretty good, we have some other issues that we need to save some fish for, basically.
Okay, so that's interesting. And there's no give on that. I mean, that's like they wouldn't consider, you know, making it the 10th of September, for instance.
No.
A lot of these, it does seem a little arbitrary.
A lot of these decisions sound arbitrary, but they've been through a pretty rigorous scientific evaluation. For example, the minimum numbers. In the Klamath River, it's 40,700 that we need to have back to natural area spawners, not hatcheries. That was developed over a long period of time, and after several iterations, we're at where we are now. And again, based scientifically, and the first objective of this whole process is conservation. I mean, the fish are first. Because if the fish do well, everything else flows from that. So
right.
we're really focused on making sure that we do a good job on the conservation side at the beginning.
And the truth is that if the fish are not doing well, we don't have an industry either.
Right.
So, it's critical
right.
that the fish are doing well.
Well, and there's a lot of variables about having salmon. The one we can't control at all are ocean conditions. And that's what has depressed populations over the last 3 years prior to this, and even this year to some extent.
Yeah, because I think I remember you saying that you didn't think 2018 was going to be a great season.
Yeah, well...
Wait a minute, are you a weather forecaster?
with some embarrassment, I will tell you this. I don't do all this math, and you know that's
right.
the biologists do that, and they
right.
give us a forecast. And last year we talked about the problems on the Klamath River with parasite loading. And the parasite load for the brood year that we would have seen this year was even higher than last year when we closed the season because of no Klamath fish.
Wow.
So we make that pronouncement in advance, I did anyway, to try and get people ready for that.
Right.
Well, as often happens, Mother Nature says, okay, folks, I'll tell you how it's going to be.
And so slightly different than you thought.
what actually happened, we think, is that the ocean conditions improved much more quickly than they were forecast to do, and particularly down in that area where our fish went. Now, there's still some problems north off the coast of Washington. There's still a lot of warm water there. But generally, the ocean is doing much better. So we should see...
And when you say it's doing better, you mean that it's colder?
Colder. It's more oxygenated.
Okay.
And it's got the right type of food in it. So the temperature really determines what type of microorganisms
right.
are out there, zooplankton, particularly things called copepods,
okay.
which juvenile salmon feed on very heavily, and also forage fish feed on, like herring and sardines. So when copepods are abundant, particularly the northern ones, there's three kinds. There's two northerns and one southern. The two northerns are ones that are found in cold water, and they are the equivalent of cheeseburgers. The southern
cheeseburger.
The southern copepod is the equivalent of lettuce. So if you have northern copepods, and I say that because the northern ones are very lipid rich. They have a lot of fat and oil in them, so the salmon do really well on those. The other thing we see in good ocean conditions is a lot of krill. And so if you get all of that, you set a real smorgasbord for a young salmon. They can grow quickly. And so that's what I mean by ocean conditions. We get good survival and good growth.
So do you have any idea what happened that the conditions improved? I mean, nobody was really expecting them to...
Well, they didn't expect them to improve as rapidly as they did.
Okay.
I mean, we know what caused it, the big warm water blob in Alaska and a high-pressure area that sat there and the lack of surface winds along the coast that create upwellings. That's all what caused it.
Okay.
The reverse happens now. We're getting more wind. There's no warm water blob anymore to deal with. We have an equatorial influence on the colder temperatures here called La Nina, as opposed to an El Nino. So all of that combined is what affects the ocean. So, but we can't control that.
No.
The things we can control primarily are harvest and freshwater habitat. California, politically, is challenged when it comes to freshwater habitat, particularly water.
There
are factions in California, mainly large agribusiness interests in the mm-hmm. Central Valley, who would probably prefer salmon didn't exist.
Aww.
Because they have to set water aside for salmon. Uh-huh. They have to do that primarily because there are listed stocks, endangered species listed stocks in some of those streams, San Joaquin River, for example.
Right.
So there is always a great deal of tension between water releases for agriculture and holding water back for fish.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason the fish need the water is they need to get transported to the ocean. And when they do that, right. they have to have sufficient flow.
Right.
Also, they need their reds, once they lay the eggs in a bed called a red, they need those to not be dewatered by dropping the, in this case, the discharge out of Shasta Dam.
So okay.
That's complicated.
It is complicated. And you know, when you kind of try to step back from it, you have... food production, basically, I mean, that's what agribusiness or agriculture, agribusiness is supposed to be doing, is producing food, right? So you've got food production versus kind of food production.
Exactly. And you have endangered species issues.
Mm-hmm.
And not just salmon. I mean, you have issues in the Delta, the San Francisco Bay Delta, with other types of fish that are also listed.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a pretty thick political morass to wade
mm-hmm,
through.
Mm-hmm.
And California has more of one thing than anybody else. They have more people in Congress. And they tend to be pretty conservative in the Central Valley.
Hmm.
I'll leave it at that.
But. Yes. Yeah. So we're back in Portland now.
Okay.
So you're sitting with your group and coming up with decisions and being sent back into committee, and how long does this process take?
We meet, the council meets 5 days. In some cases, we'll actually meet six because we'll start the day before the council meeting to get salmon on the floor early. So we're usually working pretty hard for 5 or 6 days. We start early and we quit late most
mm-hmm.
of the time
mm-hmm.
to try and get this done. Now, I will say that the salmon advisory subpanel that I'm on works pretty efficiently. I mean, we've cut to the chase. We don't do all the poker game stuff and the posturing. We know what we have to do. And so
right.
it's just a negotiation. All right, how much do you need? And here's what I need. And how can we get to a number that will work for both of us?
Right. And that's kind of a nice thing that, you know, you're trying to get to yes. I mean, that's obviously, that's sure. what you're trying to do. And if people are willing to, you know, do a little give and take stuff, then you can get there.
Well, this year was a good example because both California and Oregon were closed in the Klamath Management Zone last year. We had no fishing at all.
There was no salmon fishing last year.
Right. In that zone.
Wow.
And that goes from Humbug Mountain right below Port Orford to just below Eureka, California. That entire area was closed. So when we came in this year, there was pretty general understanding among everybody that showed up at the SAS that we would work first and foremost to have salmon fishing in those two areas. And so the people in San Francisco made and Monterey made concessions to move fish north. They made concessions to us to allow some fish to stay in Oregon. And be caught in Oregon. So it was a pretty, I think I would describe it as a pretty thought out and well-intentioned process this year.
Mm-hmm. Well, I noticed that there were, you gave a presentation at the Port Commissioner meeting, and I think it was like the next day or two, there was going to be a meeting in Port Orford where people could give their input and
right.
or maybe
actually it was in Coos Bay, but
Coos Bay, right.
there is a formal council sponsored meeting in each state for public input. So on that night, we met in Coos Bay. At the same time, there was also a meeting in Washington, and the next night there was one in California. And those are formal meetings where the council sends people to take testimony.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's again part of the process.
Sounds like a really good process.
It's involved,
mm-hmm.
but it has to be because of the complexity. I mean, this is all done under the direction of fisheries management plans for both Chinook and Coho.
And these plans came from where?
From the Pacific Fisheries Management Council.
Right, got it.
This is also subject to international treaty with Canada.
Oh.
So we have obligations both within the fisheries management plan and within the Pacific Salmon Treaty that we have to meet. And that's another effort to share those fish. All those fish that turn north swim right by Canada on the way, up and back.
Because some of them are going to Alaska.
They spend most of their time in Alaska, Southeast Alaska, and then as they return, they come past British Columbia.
Right.
So.
And you can't blame them for wanting some of that delicious salmon, right?
Well, some of those salmon turn off and go to their rivers, too. So the salmon treaty is a sharing plan between the United States and Canada to make sure they don't over-harvest and allow enough fish to come back for us.
Mm-hmm.
So, that adds to the complication of all this.
Oh, yeah, but yeah.
In my opinion, this is a pretty successful process and has a long history of success. We've had ups and downs in these populations all the time, and it has very little to do with fishing. The fishing is the most carefully regulated piece of all of this. We've had problems with freshwater environments because of drought, and we've had problems with ocean conditions, but the limiting factor is seldom ever fishing because it's carefully controlled.
Yeah, and that's great, right? If there's actually something you can control, then you do
it,
right?
That's the goal. Yeah. Well, yeah, unfortunately, sometimes it's the only thing you can control, and so we get cranked on pretty hard when it's not our issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's not enough water in the Sacramento River and that population diminishes because of it, the only people who pay for that are the fishermen.
Mm.
So that's frustrating.
Yeah, and yeah, it would be. And it's not just that you pay for it in terms of, oh, well, you can't have some fish to freeze. It's the commercial fishermen.
Well,
that's their livelihood.
It's a significant economic impact. I mean, we saw last year in this community what happens when the salmon fishermen don't come. I mean, if you go to the port, it's an entirely different feel down there when we don't have a salmon season going in the summer.
No, absolutely.
It's a way different atmosphere.
So I remember we used to have a Slam and Salmon Derby, and that usually was on Labor Day, I believe.
Right.
So how did we get away with that?
Well, the years in which we have abundant stocks.
Mm-hmm.
Those September credit card fish don't mean much.
Ah, okay.
We don't catch enough when we have a lot of fish to matter.
Mm-hmm.
But in years when we don't, then it did matter. And it has hurt us in the past, having those September harvests.
It did.
So the original people that started the Derby got out of it and handed it off to the port.
Right.
The port ran it a couple of years, and now they're willing to hand it off to somebody else.
Right. Right.
To do. I have been encouraging anybody that wants to do a salmon derby to not do it on Labor Day.
Right.
I've suggested somewhere around the 4th of July. That's a very dependable time, both in terms of having fish here and also having a season. Almost always we can pull something off around that time period, but getting in September is really hard some years.
Now, what's it like out on the ocean in July?
Generally starting to get better. July and August are usually the better months weather-wise for us.
So maybe if instead of the 4th of July, we pushed it back to, August or the beginning of August
early
August.
Yeah.
But then you're not sure you're going to have a season, right?
Well, it depends on which stock we're worried about. If it's Klamath fish, our highest Klamath impacts are in August.
Mm-hmm.
Second highest are in July.
Okay.
So if we're constrained by Klamath fish, then we have to be careful about what we do in August.
Okay.
Particularly. Sacramento's are not quite that way. Our highest impacts are in July and fewer in August.
Okay. So it actually does make sense to kind of look at July.
Well, it does from my perspective. Now, there's the other side of that is it's the last big fling before the winter comes and...
Right.
People
economically.
Like that big economic shot at the end.
Yeah, exactly.
But I'm just talking from a practical sense, from the salmon season setting part of it, it's much easier if we did that in July rather than on Labor Day.
Well, and if there's a danger of there not being any fish, then it doesn't really work to have something. That doesn't work.
I think one of the problems is that in order to make that derby successful, it appears that you need to have a lot of repeat customers. So it's hard to have one and then not have it for a couple of years and have one and not have it again because you lose that.
Exactly.
So trying to find a dependable time to do that from a season perspective would be better, I think.
Right. Because the economic impact on this community of having a derby is enormous.
Sure.
I mean,
well, when you bring in 800 fishermen
with their families,
that's a pretty big deal.
It's huge, and they're here for 2-3 days. I mean, it's a big deal. I mean, I remember the first year I went down to the port when there was a derby down there, and it was packed. It was packed with people. It was an amazing sight.
Well, you asked me a little bit about the meeting and the process.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've been in the wildlife business for 50 years now, since I took my first paycheck.
I'm in Nevada.
Right. And okay. I've been a volunteer for a long time.
Yeah.
But people always say, oh, what a great job. I mean, don't you love the outdoors mm-hmm. and all the animals?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what it's about. What it's about is working with people of passion who care about a great deal about what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And when I left the professional life to do this other stuff, I thought, well, I may not ever see that again, but I see that at the council. It's the same kind of people there. And it, you know, commercial fishermen from Astoria or the charter boat operator from Ilwaka, Washington, or a retired fireman from Eureka, California. We all sit in there with a common passion for what we're doing. We care a great deal about this stuff.
And I think that's the only way good decisions get made is if you actually have a dog in the fight, you know, you care about it.
Absolutely.
How long have you been working with the fisheries management?
You know, I forget. I think I've been doing this salmon advisory subpanel with PFMC for 12 or 13 years now.
That's a long time.
We serve 3-year terms, mm-hmm. unlimited number, but mm-hmm. they're 3-year terms. My current term is up this year, and I'm going to reapply for one more, but in that intervening 3 years, I really need somebody from this community to step up and say, all right, I want to learn how to do this to replace you, because it's very important for us that the Oregon recreational fishing representative come from Brookings or Gold Beach.
Why?
Because for all the reasons I talked about, all those impacts,
mm-hmm.
And this wouldn't be done maliciously, but mm-hmm. if you had somebody to the north of us, for example, representing recreational fishing, they may not be as stubborn about impact staying here as I am. Because for the number of impacts I have, they have many fewer. So if we took 10 impacts from me and gave it to them, they could get a lot more fishing out of that than we could.
Right.
So they wouldn't do it maliciously, but it would be possible to have that sort of thing happen. So I think it's really, and traditionally, the person that represents Oregon sport fishing on that panel has come from here.
Mm-hmm. So you got 3 years to replace yourself.
To have somebody come and learn.
And you don't get to quit until you've replaced yourself, Rich.
Yes, I do. what they have to learn is the process. They don't mm-hmm. have to be fish biologists. They don't have to be any kind of biologist, mm-hmm. any kind of expert in natural resource management. They need to learn this meeting process. It's a very formal dance that you have to learn when you need to put things in and what you need to do. And it's not that, it's daunting at first, but it's not that complicated once you figure it out. And if we had some time so they could accompany me to a meeting, then we could sit down and talk about it. And I'll explain to them, okay, here's what we're going to do and here's why we're going to do it. So they can become familiar with what has to happen.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about Oregon South Coast Fishermen. That's an organization that you belong to, and
I do.
I'm assuming that this organization is active in this whole process.
Well, they are. Mm-hmm. I mean, they always provide formal input to the council on, mm-hmm. on what option they would like to see, usually in the form of a letter. I also meet with them every year, like I do with the port, to get their comment. Mm-hmm. And then we take that back as part of the public process. But what they really do is work with the state. I mean, there's a thing called the Salmon and Trout Enhancement Program in Oregon that is funded by a surcharge on licenses, fishing licenses. And with that, there are 13 step biologists assigned to each district. And that step biologist is directed to work with the public on fisheries programs. So that's where we get involved with the habitat work, where we get involved with surveying inventory on fish populations, where we collect scales to determine age structure for the Chetco River fish. All those kind of things come out of that STEP program. And that's what the South Coast fishermen are all about.
And that determines the health of our salmon.
Well, you know, this is all data-driven. And mm-hmm. salmon are tough because we only see them when they're little and we see them when they're getting ready to die.
Mm-hmm.
So the most, as much data as we can collect to inform decisions just makes the process work more efficiently and we make better decisions. So when we started scale sampling in 2008, the state had been doing it on their own with seasonal people, and we were averaging scale samples around 50 per year. Since South Coast fishermen got involved using our own drift boats and our own crews, we collect on average about 400 a year.
Wow.
So we've collected well over 10,000 scale samples now. And what the scales do is you can read them. It's kind of like tree rings. They have little rings in them. And you can tell the age of the fish, and you can also tell whether it's a hatchery fish or a naturally produced fish. So we look at the age structure on the Chetco and also the hatchery wild ratios. And that's why we're really doing the scales. Once they figure out the age structure, the state guys can go back and back calculate what's out there in the ocean. So that's the question I always get asked is, well, how do you know how many fish are in the ocean?
Mm-hmm.
So in the case of Chinook, we'll see a fair number of two-year-old fish. These are usually precocious males that are spawning way early. Most Chinook mature at four. They'll come in and spawn. So when we look at the twos, that gives us a pretty good opportunity to say, based on previous years, this looks like a pretty good number of fish. Therefore, we think there's this many three-year-olds in the ocean. And once we have the three-year-old number, and then we start looking at scales and get a ratio to how many threes, fours, and fives come back, then we can go from there to determine how many four-year-olds are probably out there and so on.
So do you feel like you get pretty good numbers? I mean, it sounds to me like, you know, it's, well, it could be.
Well, here's what I'll tell you about all this process and the models that I've observed is that in years of high abundance, most of the models work pretty well. They're mm-hmm. pretty accurate. In years of low abundance, they go tilt.
Hmm.
And for example, the number of fish estimated to be in the Sacramento River this year based on modeling is in most people's estimation, these are people from California, in their estimation, it's way low. And it's way low for two reasons. The model tends to overestimate during low abundance. And it also has a feature called an autocorrelation feature built into it, which says if it overestimated last year, it'll take a step downward to try and come closer this year.
Right.
So it sets itself lower.
Right.
What they're seeing in the ocean are lots of juvenile fish. Last year, they said there were so many juvenile fish out there that they couldn't get out of them. So there's some, at least some speculation that that number is actually pretty low.
Hmm.
And there will be more fish out there than forecast. But that's anecdotal information, and we can't use that as part of the process. You have to, by regulation, you have to use the best available science, and that's not it. So.
Right. So you said that you've got a mix of hatchery and wild fish that are coming back up. And how can you tell the difference between them?
Well, the hatchery fish are clipped. So they've taken the adipose fin, which is a little fleshy fin between the dorsal fin and the tail on the back of the fish. That's clipped off. So when we see that, we know it is a hatchery fish. When we see the carcasses on the riverbank, after they're starting to deteriorate, that isn't always there. But when
you
pull a scale off,
mm-hmm.
and you stain it and reed it, the first year age ring on a hatchery fish is much bigger than on a wild fish because they've been fed artificially, so they grow faster. So that's how they determine that, primarily. Well, I talked about cotwire tags. Well, so when they're looking at fish down here at the port and the creel samplers are looking at them, if it has an adipose fin missing, they know it's a hatchery fish. So then they have a metal wand and they rub that over the nose of the fish. And if it has a cotwire tag, which is a little thin hair-like piece of stainless steel inserted into the cartilage of the nose when they're juveniles, then they know that's got a tag in it and they cut the nose off and then that's processed.
So what's the difference? I mean, why does it matter whether they are hatchery or wild?
Well, that is a raging debate. And has been for a long time.
Okay.
So the theory is that naturally produced fish will adapt to changing conditions much more quickly than hatchery fish. In the wild...
Because they're used to adapting.
Well, in the wild, about 30% of the eggs that are laid actually produce a swim-up fry that comes out of the gravel. In the hatchery, you'll have hatch rates around 98-99%.
Okay.
So theoretically, there are some unfit fish that are being born and raised in the hatchery that wouldn't make it in the wild.
Can I just ask a question here? But the fact that only 30% turn into little fish could also have to do with them, the eggs being eaten by other things, not necessarily that the egg was bad.
No, that's true.
Right?
That's true. There are other factors. But generally, if you have a lot of eggs in the hatchery, you're going to pick some bad ones out anyway.
Okay.
And they don't get picked out in the natural setting.
So
that's the theory. And the concern is that if you... particularly with a straight hatchery program where the fish all come back to the hatchery, the hatchery fish come back to the hatchery, and you're breeding successive generations of hatchery fish, that you're going to change their capability of adapting and their fitness to spawn in the wild.
Okay.
So that's the theory. Now, in the Chetco River, we do collect broodstock for the hatchery program. That's one of the things the South Coast Fisherman does, helps the state do. But... our program is based on all taking all wild fish to the hatchery.
Okay.
And
so you are using...
So we're doing the best we can
reintroducing
to replicate
wild,
that.
Right.
There's other parts of this that aren't fully understood, like mate selection. It appears that Chinook salmon actually are pretty selective about who they mate with. It isn't just a coincidental encounter. We don't know about all that.
Right.
But we're studying that at the Hatchery Research Center in Oregon. They're looking at that, and they do that. They have this artificial stream, four of them actually, that are monitored by cameras 24 hours a day. So they'll put adult Chinooks in there, mark each one distinctively, and then see what they're going to do and see how they select where they're going to dig a red, who they're going to mate with, all those kinds of things.
That's fascinating.
It is. It is. But,
wow.
What that tells you is we don't know much about salmon. What makes them tick? I mean, we've studied big game animals, for example, where you can watch them all day, every day, and see how you'll have a dominant male that does most of the breeding and those kinds of things. But salmon are tough because you don't get to see them up close.
So are there a lot of places that the hatchery fish are, they're the only ones that come up that stream and are producing?
Yes.
There
are a number of hatcheries in the Sacramento Basin, a number of them, built as mitigation for all the dams that stop water from getting to the Sacramento River.
Right.
And a lot of those are hatchery, almost all hatchery fish now, over time. And that's mainly because most of the spawning habitat for naturally spawning fish are gone. They're somewhere up above the dam and they can't get to it.
So do they, you'd think that they would take that into consideration, that, you know, that whole interbreeding kind of thing.
Well, you have to remember that the whole hatchery snowball started rolling when they started building all these dams on the Columbia River particularly. And the theory at that time was, well, how many do you want? We'll build you a hatchery and make however many you want. We just don't want to have to try and get them above this dam. So that notion prevailed for probably 60 to 70 years until people started getting into, why don't we have the Columbia River at one time routinely produced salmon that went over 100 pounds, lots of big fish.
Oh, wow.
And 80, 90, 70, 60, you know, back when they were doing the canneries, they were getting massive fish.
Wow.
So that started to decline, and they didn't see those big fish anymore. And so people started asking, well, how come? I mean, that's kind of where this started. And over time, they've looked pretty carefully at this genetic fitness issue. And it's ongoing research right now. I mean, everybody would really like to know, is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? Now, in the case of the Chetco, it's a supplemental program. It's intended to put some more fish out there for harvest. And the theory is also that for every hatchery fish that's taken, that's one natural fish that probably will escape. So there's some rationale there. And our program is really small. We only put 200,000 juveniles back in the river, as opposed to, say, the Coleman National Fish Hatchery on the Sacramento that puts out 8 or 9 million.
Oh, okay.
So it's a small program.
So 200,000 juveniles?
Right.
Put back out into the ocean. How many of that 200,000 will actually make it back to spawn?
Oh, probably between 200 and 400.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, the survival, I mean, the return rate is pretty small, 1 to 3%, usually somewhere in there. And it's because, you know, as they're in the ocean, they're constantly subjected to predation by other fish, by birds, killer whales eat. By proportion, killer whales eat more pounds of salmon than any of the marine predators. Harbor seals, believe it or not, eat more fish, more salmon, in terms of numbers, than the other marine mammal predators. And California sea lions are somewhere in the middle.
Wow.
So you have all of those factors working. You have continual harvest programs with commercial and recreational fishing. So those fish are subjected to a constant mortality in the ocean. And then you throw in things like ocean conditions. They don't grow as big. They aren't as fat. There's all that stuff that happens to them.
So there's a fish cleaning station.
Yes.
That I've seen in the news that the South Coast fishermen are doing something with that.
You know, the cleaning station hasn't been refurbished for a long time, and it's got galvanized pipe in it, and it's starting to deteriorate and rust through. The cutting surfaces are pretty well beat up. The screen to keep the birds out is rusted out. And the expectation is, well, the port takes care of that. Well, the port has had some financial issues, I mean, with the tsunami and all the stuff that's happened. So the South Coast fishermen, several of us got together down there one day and said, well, how about if we fix this? I mean, this is a community asset. It's very important to the port to have that cleaning station there, and we can't just expect the port to do everything. So we pursued a grant through the Restoration Enhancement Program at ODFW, and we got a grant to buy the materials, and then we're going to do the labor. And that's probably going to happen within a fairly short amount of time.
Wow.
We're laying in materials right now, and we should probably get to this in early May. The delay, I mean, I wrote that grant request in September. It was approved by the R&E board in January, but it had to go through the commission, the Wildlife Commission, for final approval, and that didn't happen until late March.
Well, any granting process is like that, though. Right. It always just takes forever.
Well, this is, I mean, I'm pretty excited about the notion of doing this. We're going to replace all that galvanized with stainless steel and buy new surfaces and paint it and put a new roof on it and change the screen out and try and make it fresh.
So when do you anticipate the work being done?
Probably the second week in May.
Oh, I'm thinking. Really exciting.
Yeah, it's coming together.
So salmon season starts
19th of May.
So that's perfect if you'd have that done by the start of salmon season.
Yeah, because we're going to have to close it probably for a couple of days while we're in there doing the work.
Right.
So we're going to try and make it as easy on the community as we can in terms of not being able to use that.
And where is that fish cleaning station?
It's right at the recreational ramp, the boat ramp.
Okay.
It's just right about, I don't know, 80 feet, 100 feet above the ramp.
Okay. Okay. So you've come up with the season. You spent those 5 days in Portland doing whatever you needed to do. And, you know, are you done now in terms of this year?
Once the council is done with this, then they forward the season package to the Secretary of Commerce, who actually signs this.
Okay.
And he has to sign it by the 1st of May. So it's probably there or about to be there. And then that makes it an official season.
But the likelihood is that he's going to sign it, right?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, there's not any real reason why he wouldn't.
Yeah, and he probably won't leave it on his desk for 2 months either. Right? Like sometimes.
Not with fishermen clamoring at his door.
No.
Okay, it looks like we're just about out of time again. It's amazing to me how fast an hour goes. Do you have any final words you'd like to say? I know you're obviously looking for your replacement.
Well, the thing I always remind people is that this season setting process is about paper fish. I mean, it's all
right.
It's all math and models. The season is the season when we see what actually shows up here. If the fish come here, if they'll stay here, if there's food here, bait here, mm-hmm. water temperatures here, that's what determines how good the actual fishing will be. So that's the unknown at this point. And that will just unfold as the summer goes by.
Right, right. So the season will end at the end of August, and then I'm assuming that numbers will be calculated or...
Well, the state... Oregon is really good. They produce a report every week on how many fish are caught by port.
Great.
Okay. So that we know pretty quickly how many fish we've gotten.
Excellent.
But as far as the numbers for next year, that comes out in February usually.
Excellent. Rich, I want to thank you once again for coming on the show. It's been, again, an amazing amount of information and stuff that I think that the community really needs to know.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here. I never tire of talking about this.
So. I love it. Thank you very much. I want to thank the audience for listening as well to this segment of our community. The information that we try to get from our community leaders is, I think, very important to the community, and especially because we've got so many fishermen in the community that actually rely on the salmon population for their livelihood. My guest today has been Rich Heap, and we've been discussing our salmon season for 2018. If you are enjoying our programming, please visit us on our website, kciw.org. You can listen to podcasts, donate, or sign up to get involved. Thank you so much. I'm Candace Michelle.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.